Hi, I'm Susan Lewis. I had the chance to sit down with conductor Nicholas McGeegan when he was in town to conduct the Philadelphia Orchestra in music by Stravinsky, Respighi, Handel, Locatelli, and Rossini. We're backstage with conductor Nicholas McGeegan. That was a beautiful first half.
Oh, thanks. It's such fun to work with this orchestra and also to do music that they don't play every day.
Yes, and starting with the Respighi, which was written in 1917, but looks back at earlier music.
It looks back to music from the Renaissance. In fact, this program is not in composition order, but in terms of the music it's based on, sort of chronological. We start with Renaissance music given a facelift by Respighi. It's a sort of a colorized movie version of it. And then we go to Handel in 1735, and then we go to Locatelli in the 1740s. In the second half, you're going to hear Rossini from 1817, just over 200 years ago. And finally, we've got Stravinsky. It's the newest piece, but it's based on Baroque music in the same way as the Respighi is based on Renaissance music. So it's a little tour of Italian things, plus a little Handel in there, who spent time in Italy, so he counts.
I was going to say, it's all Italian except for Handel, but maybe not.
Well, he lived in Italy for about 5 years when he was young, and he certainly learned his musical language from Corelli and Alessandro Scarlatti. And he wrote a lot of Italian opera, of course, so he's got an Italianate side. Of course, being a German, he could also write fugues. And he played the organ, which is not a very Italianate thing to do.
Now, you've been the longtime music director of Philharmonia, Baroque Orchestra, and Chorale. What's it like coming to an orchestra like Philadelphia, playing this kind of repertoire that we heard in the first half?
Well, it's great fun. It's not so very different. The first time I came to this orchestra was in the last century, when I remember that every one, I think, of the string principals was over 80. It was what you might call the venerable Philadelphia Orchestra. Nowadays, everyone is younger and much more sparkly than me, and they've had a great deal more experience, courtesy of Yannick and other people who come in, playing earlier music. So this is not a strange language for a modern orchestra. Also, I very often travel with my own music, so if I need things written in, I write them in. And so I spend at least half my time working with modern orchestras and very often doing old stuff. So it's more and more exciting to do.
Are you looking for a different kind of sound?
Well, it's not what you might call the old Philadelphia sound, which was pretty high cholesterol, I must say, back when I was growing up in the LP days of listening to Brahms and Rachmaninoff and things. This is, I'm not looking for an early music sound in the sense of absolutely no vibrato, that kind, because they did use vibrato in the 18th century. And obviously we have to play it in such a way that makes sense in a hall this size. 18th century halls were very much smaller, so it would be a different way. If you think of an analogy of speech, if I was talking to 200 people without a microphone, it's very different to talking to 2,000 people with a microphone. So you have to be much more articulate. And that's something that modern orchestras are very good at. And they, of course, this orchestra knows this hall very well. I was here very soon after it opened and marveled at how wonderful it is. But that was when no one was used to it. Now everybody is. And it's great to be here.
Well, I understand when you were in Cambridge, you took a course in acoustics of instruments and buildings.
I did, and my father was an architect, so I got to hear all about buildings. Yes, it was great fun. I didn't think I was very good at it, but the teacher was a chap called Sir Nicholas Shackleton, and he had a tenant in the top floor of his house who was called Christopher Hogwood. That's sort of how I got into early music, so great fun.
So we're about to hear the Rossini overture, which I understand doesn't particularly relate to the themes of the opera.
No, except that the opera ends happily and the overture is happy all the time. It's got one very famous thing in it, which is sort of Rossini's calling card, which is called the Rossini crescendo, where something will start very, very, very soft and get louder and louder and louder until it pops, basically. And everybody in the 18th century would have, in the 19th century would have clapped, probably. And it is a real toe-tapper. It's a wonderful piece, great wind parts, and it's one of his most sparkly. I just happen to love the opera, which I've never ever done. Hint. but it's just such fun to do.
And then we have Stravinsky, which is very different from his earlier works, Firebird.
Very much. There's really no Russian influence in this at all. It's known as his neoclassical period. And what he's done is taken music by Pergolesi and Domenico Gallo and quite a few anonymous pieces and dressed them up. He's Stravinskyized them. Some of them are presented reasonably straight. Some of them are given his naughty Igor treatment, especially when there's a trombone around. And so
what do you mean?
Well, instead of going dum dum diddleem diddleem deem, the trombone goes dum dum and it's a little bit raspberry-esque, shall we say, which is fine because it's all based on comedy and commedia dell'arte, and Harlequin and Pulcinella, of course, is one of the comic characters in 18th century Italian drama. So it is meant to be fun, but it's also got some sentimental moments. And he takes several arias from Pergolesi, more or less verbatim. The full ballet has singers in it who sing the original arias by Pergolesi, but again harmonized and glitzed up a bit by Stravinsky. I think it's a wonderful piece, and this suite is... People who think modern music is a bit terrifying, not that this is modern, I mean, it was written in nearly 100 years ago. I think it's 1920-ish. But it's very graceful and very good fun.
And I understand it highlights different members of the orchestra throughout it.
Absolutely, and this is a very small orchestra we've got here. We've got not more than 40 people on the stage compared to sometimes 100 if you're doing a big Mahler symphony or something. So everybody gets something good to do. You've got the flutes, the oboes, no clarinets in this one, but there are in Cenerentola. Great bassoon parts, horn parts, sort of a Sergeant Pepper trumpet part, and the naughty trombone. And then you've got a solo string quintet, including solo bass, which is great fun. He's right standing right out front because he has one of the best solos in the piece.
Any particular parts to listen for?
Towards the end, there's the naughty trombone piece. That's just before the end. And the very end, which is sort of Italianate Rite of Spring. It's all the Rite of Spring rhythms, but none of the harmonies. And David, this wonderful trumpeter here, has to play the same thing over and over and over again. And if you start tapping your feet to it, you start going wrong because ever so often there's a beat missing, deliberately.
Wow. Well, I understand Stravinsky said, Pulcinella was my discovery of the past, the epiphany through which the whole of my late work became possible. What does that mean?
Well, I think he was asked to write it by Diaghilev. And I think he did a little research and thought, wow, this is wonderful. Because his training was studying with Rimsky-Korsakov and very much the big Russian tradition. Of course, the first pieces he wrote are very much for the Balearics, are very much in the Russian tradition. And then suddenly Diaghilev wanted to do this all-Italian piece based on old tunes. And he sort of had to go and do his homework, actually, and he got really into it. And that's where he found the language that kept him going for 20 years before he then went again and discovered serialism for himself, having been pretty nasty about Schoenberg for quite a long time. They were practically neighbours in LA at the time, but I'm not sure they ever met. So Stravinsky adopted then another language, but this is his middle period language. He then wrote other pieces, Apollon Musagère and the Violin Concerto and the symphonies, which are based on this sort of thing. And of course, later on, his wonderful opera, The Rake's Progress, which is based more on Mozart than on this earlier Baroque music, but still speaks the same sort of language, but with the same fun rhythms that you get in the earlier pieces.
Well, it's so interesting, and it kind of fits in with this theme of looking back and having current music informed by the past.
Absolutely. I think the whole audience ought to have espresso and biscotti, either during or in the intermission. Get them in the mood.
Great. Well, thank you so much. We look forward to the second half.
Oh, it's going to be great fun. I'm going to enjoy conducting it very much.
Can I ask you one other question?
Yeah.
I understand you got into early music, playing flute, piano,
yeah,
and then the harpsichord.
Yeah.
Yes. And that you've likened early music, particularly the harpsichord, to playing jazz.
Yeah, playing the harpsichord's a lot like playing jazz. Part of it, if you're playing continuo, which is playing in an orchestra, is that you actually don't have that much music. You've only got the left hand written down by the composer, and you have to make up the right hand playing the chords of the orchestra, and they're told you by little figures. They say five or a six, and it tells you what chords to play. A bit like guitar stuff. But you can play anything you want. And you can play a fancy or not fancy. You can overdo it, of course. So it's a little bit like playing a 12-bar or something. You've got the bass, and what you do on top is up to you. Whereas much later music, and piano music particularly, everything is written down. What you have, the tunes are written down, all the chords are written down. You play exactly what the composer wrote. And that's, of course, increasingly in the 19th century. It must be said that Mozart and Beethoven were both very famous for their improvisations, which is something I'm not very good at, but I do try. I mean, making up whole pieces with no music.
Wow.
Robert Levin, my pal, and I were doing a concert up in New York a couple of weeks ago, and he made up his cadenzas in a Beethoven concerto, and it was very exciting. We had no idea what he was going to do, and nor did he. But that's how it should be. And famous people like Bach and Handel could make up whole concerts just on the spur of the moment. And that's part of the tradition of Baroque music, also adding ornaments to the music that's already written down. You get a template from the composer, and part of your skill is to be able to make things up. Whereas the skill of 19th and 20th century music is to play exactly what's put in front of you.
Well, do you see our current musical scene being informed by jazz and by the tradition of Baroque music?
Oh, very definitely. If you go to a school like Juilliard, which has a very large Baroque music course, somebody gave them $20 million, I think, for early music. People want to join that orchestra. They give a lot of concerts. They've just done a fully staged Rameau opera and stuff. So, and lots of people go, give it a whirl, try the old bows. You find that at Oberlin, you find it, I'm not sure about Curtis, but probably there's certainly some of it going on. So people, it's not, used to be a separate world, and now it's becoming an integrated one. And that's very good.
That's great. You seem so infused with a sense of joy about this music. Where does that come from?
Well, I really love it. I really do. I grew up playing in orchestras. Sometimes you had grim conductors. And I never thought I'd be a conductor, but I'd certainly decided not to be grim.
Is it possible to describe what music means to you?
What music means to me? Pretty much everything. It's joy. Of course, some music makes you very sad. It heightens your emotions. And sometimes it speaks to you very, very personally. Even, of course, if you've never met the composer, he somehow seems to know what I was thinking. And it either makes you more miserable or it makes you happier. Or if you are miserable, it cheers you up. Just depends what the piece is. I cannot listen to music indifferently. So I don't play it on the car radio, I'm afraid. I sit down and listen and hope the phone doesn't ring.
Thank you so much, Nicholas McGee.
My pleasure.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.